Say big at Menards and keep cool in the summer heat with a new window air conditioner from Denali Air. Quickly and efficiently cool your spaces with auto and eco modes to maximize performance and save on energy costs. Featuring 3 fan cooling speeds and a remote control, allowing you to cool your space from anywhere in the room. Save big money on Denali Air. Plus, check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for more great deals happening this week. Save big money at Menards.
Welcome to Beg to Differ, the Bulwark's weekly roundtable discussion featuring civil conversation across the political spectrum from center-left to center-right. I'm Mona Charon, syndicated columnist and policy editor of the Bulwark. I'm joined by our regulars, Bill Galston of the Brookings Institution and the Wall Street Journal, Linda Chavez of the Niskanen Center, and Damon Linker of The Week. We're delighted to welcome as our special guest, Eric Edelman, who is rejoining us, former Undersecretary of Defense for Policy, former ambassador, and many other roles, senior roles in government. So thank you one and all for being here. It is a it's a grim day in American democracy. We had the President of the United States launch an attack on the Capitol. We are in the midst, as we speak, of resignations, of calls for the 25th Amendment to be invoked, and of course, impeachment. Let's just review to set the stage. Let's just review where we are. And Eric, I want to start with you because you orchestrated a letter, an op-ed that was published by all the living ex-secretaries of defense, warning that the U.S. military can never be used for illegal purposes and get involved in anything regarding American elections. Were there people, this was just a few days ago, did you get any response from people saying, you know, this is a little overheated, no need to worry, maybe you're overreacting? I think Chuck Hagel, you said had that reaction at first, right?
That's true, Mona. First, it's great to be back with you and the rest of the group here. It does seem, I mean, the letter was published on Monday, and it seems like a lifetime ago somehow.
Yeah.
The truth is, once I circulated the letter, the precipitating incident was actually the column by David Ignatius in the Washington Post on the 26th of December. That clearly indicated some disquiet in the senior military about what they might be asked to do by President Trump. I served as a diplomat in Moscow, and I used to read Pravda and Izvestia to try and figure out what is going on and what was going on in the Kremlin at the time. And it's a habit I've never been able to break, so I read the New York Times, Washington Post, and Wall Street Journal every day. Similarly, trying to decode what is going on.
Yeah.
And the Ignatius column, it was pretty clear to me, was coming either directly from General Milley, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, or from people around him. And I found that very troubling. And so I had been talking with my colleague at Johns Hopkins, Sice Elliott Cohen, who's one of the ranking academic experts on civil-military relations. And we kind of had the idea of maybe an op-ed, something along the lines, frankly, of an op-ed I don't agree with, which is the so-called Four Horsemen op-ed that George Shultz and Henry Kissinger, Bill Perry, and Sam Nunn signed more than 10 years ago about nuclear weapons. But I thought if we could get 3, 4, or 5 secretaries of defense to weigh in on this subject, it might have a useful chastening effect on anybody thinking about this. I spoke with Vice President Cheney about it. He agreed that might be the case and asked us to draft something up and gave us some helpful suggestions on language. When I finally started circulating it, which was not until New Year's Eve's day, I started getting back very quick acceptances by secretaries. And by kind of late afternoon of that day, we had seven. It is true that Secretary Hagel was the last to come on board, not until the next morning, really, New Year's Day. Some of that was technical difficulties in getting a hold of him, but he did seem to have some reluctance that maybe this was an overreaction. You know, in the end of the day, I think given what happened when the letter actually broke on Sunday, when it was posted to the Washington Post website, hot on the heels of the Georgia phone call between President Trump and the revelation of that phone call and Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger, I think everybody by that point realized that this was, you know, a well-needed cautionary.
Can I ask you, based on your experience and your tea leaf reading, I mean, there has been talk in the last 24, 36 hours of a so-called soft 25th Amendment. That is, that even if the 25th Amendment isn't technically being invoked, that the Pentagon would not take direct orders from the President of the United States right now, but would look to Pence and or others. What do you make of that?
Well, I think it has a little bit of surface plausibility in the sense that if you look at the statement Acting Secretary Miller made last night about the Pentagon providing the D.C. National Guard to the to Mayor Bowser and to the Metropolitan Police to help restore order on the Capitol and clear the Capitol complex. He made reference to conversations with Vice President Pence on the scene, with Speaker Pelosi, with Minority Leader McCarthy, and with the Senate majority and minority leaders, McConnell and Schumer. There's no mention at all of any conversation with the Commander-in-Chief. And so I think one can read that as people at least at a minimum trying to work around the president, you know, if not actually invoking the 25th Amendment.
Linda, what do you make of a situation in which we are in terror over the next 13 days that a guy who has been locked out of Twitter and Facebook still has access to the nuclear codes?
Exactly. And, you know, one of the things I wondered in that letter that was released, a lot of people have noted that there was far more of a presence, a National Guard presence and other federal force presence in June, back during the Black Lives Matter protests in Washington, D.C. And those, of course, were ordered by the president. And so, you know, when I first heard that, I thought, well, maybe they did ask him for the National Guard to be sent to guard Capitol Hill. And he said no. I don't know if it's possible, if that's what happened, or if, as Eric and others have suggested, that perhaps it is just a soft 25th Amendment. But there is something really frightening about the possibility that we have a man, not the possibility, the fact that we have a man sitting in the Oval Office, the Commander-in-Chief, who is out of his mind. He is absolutely unhinged. He has fomented what is essentially a seditious mob to go up to the Capitol and to break into the Capitol. And anybody who suggests that he's just thinking that they ought to go up there and, you know, exercise their First Amendment rights, that's ridiculous. What he said is that we have to take back our country.
Yep.
And taking back our country is clearly a message that we need a revolution, and a revolution requires force. And he has fomented a seditious attempt to interfere with the Congress of the United States.
Oh, he said there were, you know, there were weak Republicans and that we needed to show strength. And he said, I'm going to walk up there with you, he said to the mob. Mm-hmm. Eric, you wanted to make another point about this?
Just to Linda's point, Mona, there have been reports that during the course of the day, the president resisted efforts by the Pentagon to send the guard, into the city at that point. So I think there's probably a lot we're going to learn in the next few days, and probably a lot more we're going to learn after the 20th of January about how a lot of this played out. But it is striking that there just was no mention of the, essentially the National Command Authority when this step was taken last night.
Damon, I don't know about you. I mean, here in the Washington, D.C. area, we got, alerts on our phones, that loud buzzing that you get when there's a big storm coming or something, alerting us to the fact that we were all under curfew as of 6 p.m. There is a palpable sense of fear around here about what could happen. And there are still these huge mobs of obviously deranged and violent people who are being egged on by the President of the United States. And yet we hear that the Congress, which has the power to remove him, they could impeach and remove him quickly. But they're adjourning.
Well, it's not exactly clear what is happening with that because, Chuck Schumer issued a statement a couple of hours ago calling on Vice President Pence to kind of lead the cabinet in a 25th Amendment move to remove Trump from office. And Nancy Pelosi has actually had a press conference as of around 2 o'clock today in which she also says, quote, "I join the Senate Democratic leader in calling on the vice president to remove this president by immediately invoking the 25th Amendment. If the vice president and cabinet do not act, the Congress may be prepared to move forward with impeachment." So clearly they're keeping people around in case this has to happen. It is a little distressing that it's put in terms of May. I mean, we're caught in a bind here, and it's the same bind in a way that we were in almost a year ago when Trump was impeached, that impeachment is really hard, and especially with the incredible deadline that we're up to, we have 13 days to go. You don't want to initiate impeachment proceedings unless it can be assured to happen very quickly and to be successful. Because the idea of like spending the next 6 days or 8 days going through this kind of theatrics that then ends in him being acquitted yet again would be disastrous. So that would be bad, but it's also very difficult politically to thread that needle. As we saw, 65% of the Republicans in the House were willing to overturn the results of the election just yesterday after the events.
They voted for the coup after the attack on the Capitol.
Right.
After.
So if that's a gauge of Republican sentiment, then, there's no guarantee that there would be enough Republicans to go along with removal. And the fact that Elaine Chao, the transportation secretary, resigned today as well, one would presume, that was done in consultation with her husband, the Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, perhaps on the thought of you don't want to be caught having to make a decision about whether you're going to move against the sitting president for the first time in American history, removing him with the 25th Amendment. So we have this typical thing that we've seen for the entirety of the Trump administration where you have different groups of elites knowing what they really should do, but yet trying to toss the football back and forth to get the other one to do it so they don't have to take responsibility. And it's a real issue. I think it would be much better for the country if this is going to happen for it to be impeachment and removal, because then there is political accountability. I know that
furthermore, he can no longer hold a position of trust in the United States of America.
Yes, that would be an extra very important added bonus, because that would then remove him from the direct political calculus of him threatening to run in 2024. But but it is very difficult to accomplish. On the other hand, the 25th has never been used in this way, although it would not be a coup because it would be following the letter of the constitutional language. It smells of coupish behavior, this idea that the cabinet secretaries who are appointed are conspiring with the vice president to knock off the guy in charge and put themselves in charge.
We know how much Republicans are against coups, right?
Well, I mean, again, this isn't it's not a moral judgment. It's a kind of an analysis of the political optics of it. So none of the paths forward are great. If I had to bet, having lived through these last 4 years, I would bet that it probably will not end up going through. But the fact that here we are with only 13 days to go and large numbers of people are coming out, new ones every minute, saying we have to do this is an extraordinary development, because in only the most extreme circumstance could you imagine people taking the position. We can't risk waiting only 13 days to be rid of the guy. It's really extraordinary.
Something you said about Elaine Chao struck me, because I had thought, silly me, I'm still naive after all these years, I had thought that she was resigning to protest what happened. But you're suggesting no, it was that she wants to remove herself from the awkward position of having to decide on a 25th Amendment scenario.
Well, that's my cynical way of looking at the world, I guess you could say. But who knows what her motives are, but I could imagine, This is a huge decision. Are you going to be part of the majority of cabinet officials who are going to join together and remove the sitting president? It's very much within the realm of what you would expect, having lived through these years, to assume that people are not going to want to do that and be on the record having done it forever.
So, Bill Galston, if you'll indulge me, I'm just going to read this statement from Governor Phil Scott of Vermont, a Republican, who sort of laid it out, I thought, nicely. And then I want to hear your views about sedition, the actual legislation. But here's the quote. It's a little bit long. Bear with me. Make no mistake. The President of the United States is responsible for this event. President Trump has orchestrated a campaign to cause an insurrection that overturns the results of a free, fair, and legal election. The fact is, the results of this election have been validated by Republican governors, conservative judges, and nonpartisan election officials across the country. There is no doubt that the president's delusion, fabrication, self-interest, and ego have led us step by step to this very low and very dangerous moment in American history. The fabric of our democracy and the principles of our republic are under attack by the president. Enough is enough. President Trump should resign or be removed from office by his cabinet or by the Congress. That was from a Republican. Bill, do you share the caution that some have expressed that you shouldn't shoot at the king unless you're sure you can kill him?
I have to say that I do, Mona. I just posted a co-authored piece on the Brookings website to that effect, working through all of the options, trying to evaluate their political feasibility given current circumstances, and coming to the conclusion that weaving a web of tacit noncompliance with the president for the next 13 days, beginning but not ending with the Department of Defense, is probably the best we're going to be able to do. If I had to choose between the 25th Amendment and impeachment, I would choose the 25th Amendment, because that would originate from within the administration. No one could accuse those people of being engaged in a partisan Democratic exercise to get a Republican president. As to the optics of the coupish behavior, those arguments were thoroughly reviewed during the drafting of and debate on the 25th Amendment. That's just part of the fabric. There is no way of avoiding, for the real cynics and conspiracy theorists, the imputation of self-interest to the vice president. And who knows what kinds of corrupt bargains the vice president could cut with members of the cabinet in order to earn their support. The drafters of the amendment went down that road, and they decided that it was better to have it than not to have it. And I have to say, I agree with them. But, moral indignation has to be tempered by political realism. And if you do something that makes you feel good, but ends up making the situation worse, what have you done? So I'm in favor, I'm in favor of applying a very rigorous, as the philosophers would say, consequentialist test to every proposal. If we do this, what is the most likely result? The purity of our motives matters not in the slightest against, against the nature of the results.
Yeah, Linda.
I have a question about the 25th Amendment and a majority of the cabinet. Mm-hmm. Many of members of Donald Trump's cabinet have never been confirmed by the U.S. Senate. And I am wondering, do unconfirmed members of the cabinet get a choice in this?
Well, as a matter, you've come to the right person, Linda. I've done a really deep dive into the 25th Amendment over the past 36 hours, and two things are relevant to your question. Number one, the cabinet strictly is a sort of an amorphous term. According to the letter of the law, it applies to the principal leaders of the executive departments, which turns out to be a list of 15. I could bore you by enumerating them if you're interested. So that's point number one. It's not everybody who happens to have been elevated to cabinet status by a particular president. It's the principal leaders of the executive departments as defined by law. Secondly, it turns out that for purposes of invoking the 25th Amendment, acting heads are on all fours with confirmed heads of departments.
So they can.
So that's your. They can. That's your answer. Okay. Yeah. Okay.
That's my answer.
Thank you, Bill.
Okay, I'll shut up there.
Okay, Eric, I want to come back to you. Can you enlighten us a little bit more about what the obligations are of serving members of the military? You know, you often hear it said, military will not obey an illegal order. What is an illegal order specifically?
Well, first, let me just stipulate, Mona, I'm not a lawyer and I don't try to play one on TV. So a little bit in the eye of the beholder is the problem. I mean, an illegal order would be something that contravenes the laws of war with regard to, say, proportionality of an attack or something like that. In this instance, ordering somebody to a military person to interfere with a U.S. Domestic election or the conduct of the election by duly authorized election officials. That actually is against the law. So that would be an illegal order.
It's against the law for the U.S. military to be involved in any policing domestically, correct?
Yes, because with both Posse Comitatus and the Insurrection Act, the military is forbidden from being involved in domestic affairs. During the June Lafayette Square events, a number of us, I think it was something like 80-plus former senior defense and national security officials signed an open letter that the Washington Post published about the use of the military for purposes of policing protests. That's a very major concern. The difficulty comes in, if the president invokes the Insurrection Act, He's got pretty wide scope to do that. Now, I mean, he can't do it if there is, no real insurrection, obviously.
Wait, how do you know that? I mean, he invoked emergency powers for a spurious emergency at the border to spend money on his stupid wall.
No, you're right. And the point, though, I was trying to make is I think if he did that, if it were, completely fictitious insurrection or one that the local authorities hadn't asked federal help in suppressing, I think you would get pushback from the chairman and the other chiefs and the subordinate commanders. Now, I think, in fact, that's precisely what David Ignatius was talking about in the column that he wrote on the 26th of December, published on the 26th of December. And as I said, which I believe comes from discussions with Milley or people close to Milley. My understanding is the chiefs have actually talked and run through a lot of, permutations and combinations here of what he might do. They've talked with the general counsels of the military departments and the judge advocate generals, the JAGs of the services. And I think they, in their own minds, know where they think that line is. And I think they're prepared to push back against the president, to tell him it's an illegal order, and then to, refuse to carry it out. But that would require them ultimately to resign. And the question then becomes, sort of like the Saturday night massacre, in the Nixon administration, how far down the chain do you have to go before you find somebody who's willing to actually execute this order? And I think one of the things that was on the minds of the 10 secretaries of defense who signed the letter, I don't want to, impute things to them, but my sense is from my dealings with them that they had in mind putting a shot across the bow, both of the acting Secretary of Defense, Secretary Miller, and the civilian appointees around him that President Trump has sent over to the department since the firing of Mark Esper, but also lower down in the chain of command to the, 05s and 06s, 07s, brigadier generals, colonels, lieutenant colonels, that there might be consequences for this if they were to actually execute an order that others had resigned over.
Bill, did you want to add something?
Yeah, I just wanted to ask Eric to clarify something. And that is to distinguish between what you're calling the military on the one hand and the National Guard on the other. Because the National Guard is frequently involved in what we would call policing or maybe macro policing, preserving or restoring order during times of domestic disturbance. And isn't it the case that the president and only the president has the right to call out the National Guard of the District of Columbia?
That is correct. I mean, not the president, it's the Pentagon. It falls under the guidance of the Pentagon because the guard in other states is really subject to the governor. And there is no governor in the District of Columbia. So it's a kind of anomalous.
But the Pentagon is in the chain of command at the top of which is the President of the United States.
Correct, Bill. That's correct.
So,
and that was one of the scary moments yesterday, was that we were reading as these things were unfolding, that the mayor had requested help from the National Guard and that the request had gone to the Pentagon, where Esper, as we know, had been fired, and that initially the response was no, presumably at the orders of the president.
And there's another, of course, concerning possibility, which is, that if there were some kinds of protests like the ones we had, in June in D.C., that the National Guard would be sent in over the objections of Mayor Bowser and the municipal authorities in the district, and not with their cooperation and, and coordination. I mean, that's, the other, side of the coin, as it were.
Damon, this conversation about, members of the military and going down the chain of command until you can find someone to carry out an illegal order. Look, in the past, I would have thought, you know, the U.S. military may have a few bad apples, but, you know, it's full of fine, upstanding men and women who are patriots and take their responsibilities seriously and understand the difference between legal and illegal, right and wrong. And then you get the sense, okay, this woman who was killed tragically yesterday at the Capitol was a something like a 12-year Air Force veteran, complete whack job, believes everything that the QAnon people are putting out. The former National Security Advisor of the United States, General Flynn, is one of the chief conspiracists in the country today. He was the former head of the DIA. You know, you start to lose faith that people in America in general have good sense and have their heads screwed on right.
Well, absolutely. I mean, I don't know exactly what to say about that. I sort of see it as a reflection of the spread of these kinds of malicious conspiracy theories throughout the electorate as a whole, especially on the right. And there are a fair number of conservatives in the military, and therefore you're going to get a fair number of these people there as well. Clearly, there is nothing in the military training or the culture of the military that is weeding this out, which is very distressing. But I guess after Wednesday's events, it definitely feels like the bigger threat is that bigger thing, the fact that this is spread throughout the population. And actually, this brings up something that I've seen while we've been recording this on Twitter. Matthew Iglesias, who's been a guest on the podcast before, just tweeted a simple point that I think we need to keep in mind as well about this prospect of trying to impeach the president just 13 days before inauguration. He says, "This might feel crazy, but keep in mind, there is literally no other check on pardon power, and in the District of Columbia, all crimes are federal crimes, so there is no state charge you can bring against violent mobs acting at the president's behest." Oh. And then he goes on and points out that the larger issue is that the combination of unchecked pardon power with the lack of D.C. statehood opens the door to a completely legal form of mob rule in which a presidentially aligned militia murders his enemies and gets pardoned. Now, that sounds insane that we would be concerned about such a thing. But frankly, after what we saw yesterday, I don't see how you can rule it out, especially while the people Trump invited to Washington to defend him are still lurking about.
Very much so. Eric,
I'm more concerned about that than I am about the general. I tend to have, perhaps misplaced, but I have faith in the upper reaches of the military, Flynn aside, that they're on the right side of these things. I mean, I think if Trump, say, did attempt a coup of his own on January 20th and tried to stay in power, which I don't think he's going to do, I feel pretty safe in presuming that the Joint Chiefs wouldn't listen to him for 1 second past noon on the 20th.
No, but Damon, my point was that Eric said, you know, they would have, rather than fulfill an illegal order, they would have to resign. So then you get this, you know, whisper down the lane thing where the next guy in line might have to resign too because he has principles. And then the guy below him might be a QAnon believer. You see what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, then you might have a situation. But the thing is, if it's 1 second past noon on January 20th, then it's no longer disobeying an order by the commander in chief. It's now some guy who's hanging out in the White House and has no business being there.
No, he's no longer
the president. Now, if it comes to Trump tomorrow saying nuke Tehran, or Beijing, then you enter the situation where they have to decide, what are they going to do? Are they going to stand up to the commander-in-chief and effectively launch a coup against him, or are they going to resign and then begin the process you're talking about?
Yeah. Eric.
Well, just two things, Mono. First, you know, one of the things I think that was on the mind of the secretaries was the fact, since you mentioned Lieutenant General Flynn, that he had been, according to many press reports, in the Oval Office discussing the imposition of martial law in seven of the contested states and then rerunning the election somehow under military occupation. So I think they had that in their minds when they did the letter. But, you know, to Damon's point, you know, about that Matt Iglesias was making about the pardon power. I mean, before we came on, Linda and I were having a little discussion. I hope that the people who are being charged and the people who they're now identifying who were part of this insurrection yesterday are not just charged with, you know, trespassing and vandalism and destruction of government property, et cetera, but are charged under Title 18 of the U.S. Code for seditious conspiracy, which carries with it a punishment of up to 20 years, because that's what they were engaged in. And and to do less, I think, will be to encourage more of this in the future.
Absolutely. And by the way, there's a lot of evidence that this was an extremely well-planned operation. There were sister protests in other parts of the country and at state legislatures. There was a lot of chatter on social media about how to smuggle weapons into the district because the district has strict gun laws. There were trucks with guns and ammunition found. There were IEDs on the grounds, discovered on the grounds of the Capitol. And there were pipe bombs found at the, reportedly found at the both the offices of the DNC and the RNC. Linda, you wanted in.
I mean, obviously, we're sitting here talking about pardon power. If he stays in office one more day, he can pardon himself. He can pardon each and every person charged, if they are indeed charged, as Eric suggested, with a seditious behavior, conspiracy. It clearly was a conspiracy. And by the way, it was in plain sight. The conspiracy happened on Parler, the new alternative to Facebook. I mean, the president may have been banned possibly for life, but at least until his term ends from Facebook. There are alternatives. And all of this was planned in plain sight.
Bill, something like, I think we said 65% of the Republican caucus voted for the coup. It is Amy Walter of the Political Report, Cook Political Report, had an interesting tweet thread where she points out that over time, when you look at whether Republicans identify more with the party or with Trump, more identify with Trump than with the party by significant margins. I don't know how else to say this other than I'm not sure that democracy survives when one party is the authority, believes openly in authoritarianism and not in democracy.
Well, I'm not either. And if this isn't the time for a real gut check on the part of Republicans who are decent and honorable, remain in the party as elected officials, I don't know what is. And at some point in the next few years, decent and honorable Republicans are going to have to figure out how to translate their discontent into a more effective political strategy than anything they've demonstrated so far. And that could include the formation of a new political party. Let's call it, just for laughs, the Conservative Party. That would identify with the kinds of principles that brought you and Linda and so many others into politics on the Republican side. It's clear that if you have a substantial number of people who identify as Trump acolytes first and Republican second, and people who rightly think of themselves as Republicans first and Trumpsters never, are prepared to go along with them, then you're talking about a real danger. The people that you're talking about by themselves, the hardcore, not surrounded by the soft corona of people who, for one reason or another, are prepared to vote as they vote. That hardcore by itself would be an irritant, but it seems to me not a fatal threat to democracy. So I don't think the Trump forces hold the future of the Republic in their hands. I think it's people who have been Republicans for life who actually hold the balance of power. And if they are prepared at some point to do the right thing, then that would make it impossible for the Trump forces to hold office except in some local elections.
Damon, there's a view. I held it for about 45 minutes yesterday afternoon. that this could really be the thing that discredits the Trump movement. It could be like the bombing of the Murrah building in Oklahoma City or similar events where an extremist does something that's so horrific that people recoil in horror. And I thought perhaps this might be that kind of a moment. And then I saw that a quick poll, now it may not be accurate, whatever, take it with a grain of salt, but 45% of Republicans said they approved of the storming of the Capitol.
Yeah. I mean, I'm very cynical when it comes to the Republican electorate by this point. I think there's been such an infrastructure of media organizations and then political opportunists who have cultivated, with the president being the worst example among them, but with people like Ted Cruz and Josh Hawley being newer entrants in this, that the idea of that being broken anytime soon, I think, is probably far-fetched. I will say, and I can't believe I'm actually going to say something positive about Mitch McConnell, in looking for any ray of light of something more positive in this mess, the fact that Mitch McConnell began the events yesterday afternoon, Wednesday afternoon, before the debate was shut down by the insurrectionists breaking into the Capitol, he gave a very strong statement at the beginning of deliberations in the joint session of Congress, in which he unambiguously said, enough is enough. The president was in his right to raise objections. He did so. These have been adjudicated in more than 60 court cases. They have been rejected unilaterally. It is over. It is time to certify this election. Now, granted, think of how bad off we must all be now that a statement that anodyne can seem like heroism. However, that is, in fact, exactly where we are. And the fact that the now outgoing majority leader in the Senate was willing, though, to stand up and actually say that in the face of the insurrectionists and the president and all the people who he's been organizing to try to overturn the election is a kind of line in the sand that if, you know, McConnell can do all kinds of things to contribute to our polarization and animosity and, you know, hyper-partisanship for decades, but at this point, when it came time, the absolute last moment, he did flinch and pull back from it. And that is the beginning of an opening toward what I think you're suggesting, or what Bill was suggesting, that that the path forward is toward a kind of separation between those who are willing to go along with this kind of nosedive into outright authoritarianism, and those who say, no, we will not do that, even if it means that the right side of the spectrum will be divided right down the middle and no one on that side is ever going to win the presidency for another generation. It's a kind of kamikaze mission, but it might be one that out of which something better might be born down the road. And so I appreciated that McConnell at least took that stand.
He actually even went further. He said that if the Congress takes the unconstitutional step of throwing out the votes of the states, that it will be the unraveling of our democracy. I mean, so it was exactly. A very strong statement. But I'm just going to say I'm not as cheerleading for McConnell as some, because my sense. Alas, I mean, I it's great that he made that statement, and it was very good to hear, and so on. But over the years, he has done so much to enable and to support and to block and tackle for this president, and it's like he knew what he was doing. He knew the danger of this man to our system. You know, when there was bear with me on an analogy here. There was a small, you know, fire in the basement, and he had a fire extinguisher, and he chose not to use it. And then when the entire building was on fire, he comes with his fire extinguisher and says, okay, here I come. I'm ready. You know, it's like, well, now it's not helpful. Now, it's not useless, but it's not going to make that much of a difference. And so
I agree.
Late.
I agree. My last point on it would be simply to say that, you know, since Sarah Palin, basically, in 2008, the story of the Republican Party has been trying to ride a tiger, and it continually turns around and eats the person on its back. And, you know, finally yesterday, McConnell said, I'm getting off that tiger, and at least, yeah. You know, late, better late than never, I would say.
Yeah. Okay. Everybody wants in on this. So Linda, then Bill, then Eric.
Well, first of all, I should announce to our listeners, because I don't think I've announced this on the podcast yet. I did, in fact, leave the Republican Party. I have re-registered, and I am now unaffiliated in the state of Maryland. And I did it before the insurrection. But it doesn't matter that I've left the Republican Party. What would matter is if some really prominent people left the Republican Party. And my first nominee to do so is Senator Mitt Romney. I think he should leave the party. I think he should become an independent. I would hope that Ben Sasse would consider doing the same thing. Who knows? Maybe even Senator Toomey would agree to do this. I think if you had a handful of people who were prominent, who were principled, doing this, you would see a change. And until that happens, clearly the Republican Party, as it now stands, cannot be salvaged. And so it's going to take rebuilding something new. And in order to do that, you have to see people willing to risk their jobs, willing to risk their prominence by leaving the party.
My son, the history PhD student, told me that this would be the time to read up on the origins, the death of the Whig Party and the origins of the Republican Party. He recommended Eric Foner, Free Soil, Free Labor, Free Men. I've ordered it. Bill Galston.
Yeah, well, this is a political science-y point that may have some actual political consequences down the road. Over the past 24 to 36 hours, there has been a very sharp contrast between Republicans in the House and Republicans in the Senate.
Mm-hmm.
Right? We're using numbers like 60 to 65%, you know, to characterize the behavior of the House Republican caucus. The relevant number in the Senate is 7.
Yeah.
That is to say 7 out of 51, which works out to a little bit more than 15%. And that number in the wake of the insurrection was cut in half.
Yeah.
So 7 out of the 14 jumped ship. As far as I can tell, no Republicans in the House jumped ship. Mm-hmm. And a shocking 138 House Republicans voted to uphold the objection to the Pennsylvania slate of electors. So, you know, I think, you know, there are a few babies in that bathwater that I wouldn't want to throw out completely, because I think that a lot of Republican senators, given the opportunity, could be part of the solution rather than part of the problem. The House of Representatives, with so many Republicans from districts where the only thing they have to fear is not fear itself, but rather a primary, I think they're a lost cause. And, you know, like a big pothole will need to be paved over somehow.
Yeah. Let me just give the role of shame here. And I commend the very strong editorial by George Will about these guys. But the names are Senator Josh Hawley, Senator Ted Cruz, Cindy Hyde-Smith, Roger Marshall, Rick Scott, Tommy Tuberville, and John Kennedy. It is a role of shame, and they all know better. Okay, Eric.
So two things. One, as a history PhD, your son's recommendation is excellent.
Good.
Eric Kohler's book on the rise of Republican ideology is a great book, even 50, 60 years after the fact of having written it. And Bill has heard me say in other contexts that, you know, I used to be a Democrat. I became a Republican. I'm prepared to become a Whig. So I think, and to pick up on Bill's point about the senators, several of whom got off of this train after the events of yesterday. And I noted a couple even in the House when I looked at the roll call vote, a couple of members who had gotten very Trumpy, but who I think, you know, should know better, actually bailed. And even though they had signed on to the amicus brief for the Paxton lawsuit and other things, actually ended up voting nay last night, not I. And so on the objections. And so I take some hope from that in the sense that I think it's going to take a little bit of time for people to process what happened yesterday. I think it's going to take a time for public opinion to settle into exactly what they think of what happened. And I think it's going to be overwhelmingly negative in terms of people's view of it, and shameful. And I think as a result of that, I think you're going to see, potentially some change. Bill may want to comment on this, but it took the Democratic Party the better part of a generation to get over the taint of insurrection after 1860. Now, in the 21st century, things move, you know, much faster, and we tend to forget things more easily, I guess. But I'm not sure that unless a lot gets done in the Republican Party in the next few weeks and months, that they're going to get over the taint of what happened yesterday very quickly.
Damon.
Yeah, the only thing I wanted to add when we're talking about roles of shame, I see here Rush Limbaugh made the following comment on his radio show today. Quote, "There's a lot of people calling for the end of violence. I am glad Sam Adams, Thomas Paine, the actual Tea Party guys, the men at Lexington and Concord didn't feel that way." So, you know, that is, I think, that really is the key. I mean, Rush Limbaugh has been doing this for like, what, about 30 years now almost? Mm-hmm. And I remember listening to him in my 20s, driving around in the car, and I would hear him, and you would feel the kind of visceral excitement of this guy who was portraying his listeners on one side of some battle against the evildoers on the other side. And he's just been doing it and stoking it like crazy. He's now in closer with the president than any president he's ever been in power since he's been doing this shtick. And so he's fully out there pushing this line. And until that stops, I fear there is going to be this this seething cauldron of anti-democratic ire just at a low boil, and maybe a higher boil as we move down the road. It's very distressing.
Yeah, and we should probably devote some time in coming weeks, to talking about possible reforms in social media and elsewhere to these unbelievably destructive outlets, really, for conspiracy thinking and misinformation, and what we can do about that while still maintaining the First Amendment. This is a huge aspect of what we're living through. All right. On that note, we have come to our last segment. So, Linda, let's start with you. Your final thoughts.
I'm going to start the shaming process and that you're talking about, because you know a lot of people are wonder where this all came from, and I want to refer people back to a column that was written by Michael Anton in the Claremont Review of Books, and he wrote it back in September of 2016. He wrote it under the pseudonym Publius. A ridiculous and I think
affectation
yes of sacrificing your life for the greater good. A third century Roman consul who did that exact thing. And let me just I'll condense it, but let me just read how that piece opened. 2016 is the Flight 93 election. Charge the cockpit or you die. You may die anyway. You or the leader of your party may make it into the cockpit and not know how to fly or land the plane. There are no guarantees except one. If you don't try, death is certain. To compound the metaphor, a Hillary Clinton presidency is Russian roulette with a semi-auto. With Trump, at least, you can spin the cylinder and take your chances. Well, thank you, Michael Anton. Thank you, all of those intellectuals on the right who gave us the seditious action that happened yesterday.
Yeah. Eric Edelman.
I know you prize civility on the show, but I'm really not feeling that civil after watching what happened yesterday. And I know that, you know, we have gotten used to marking time in the Trump era by Scaramucci's, as in we have 1.5 Scaramucci's left in Trump's term. But I noticed this week that we have another new metric, this time for intelligence, which is all the blind quotes from Republicans trashing Josh Hawley and Ted Cruz, who went to Stanford, Yale, and Princeton, Harvard, respectively, because they're not morons like Louis Gohmert. So we now have the Gohmert as a measure of intelligence, as in he's two Gohmerts shy of a full load. He's not the brightest Gohmert in the chandelier. He's not the sharpest Gohmert in the drawer.
That's great. Fair enough. Okay. Bill.
I once spent a plane ride with him. Don't get me started. Well, first of all, you know, I want to begin with a note of consolation to Linda Chavez by saying that you didn't leave the Republican Party. The Republican Party left you.
To quote Ronald Reagan.
Right.
Yes, exactly.
Thank you, Ronald Reagan.
Yeah.
Having said that, you know, as an only partly defrocked former college professor, I have a reading assignment for everybody who's interested in the legal framework for the conversation that we just had and probably will be continuing to have for quite some time. Namely, go to the U.S. Code and read the paragraph defining sedition. people who have been talking about seditious behavior in the past day involving the President of the United States may have been thinking that they were talking analogically. They are not. What happened yesterday falls in the black letter heart of the legal code's definition of sedition. Like others on this show, I very much hope that the authorities throw the book at the people who really profaned the Democratic Holy of Holies yesterday, the Congress of the United States, and a plain reading, facial reading of the U.S. Code suggests that the President of the United States is just as guilty from a legal standpoint as any of the actual invaders themselves, and from a moral point of view, more so.
Yes, excellent. Okay, Damon.
Well, it's unfortunate with Eric as our guest. We, of course, had no opportunity this week to really talk about foreign policy or even the foreign policy implications of what happened this week. But on that note, I wanted to highlight a very good piece by Ann Applebaum that posted this morning on Thursday in The Atlantic titled, What Trump and His Mob Taught the World About America. Because I do think as tempting as it is when we're going through the spasm of civic unrest at home to kind of fixate on ourselves without thinking about the outside world, there's a lot to be distracted by. We live in a world that is so transparently connected on media. The entire world was watching that with us yesterday. And the lesson has done incalculable harm and will just continue to do so. It's impossible to believe that the statements of the Organization of American States, countries throughout the Americas that have suffered coups and authoritarian dictatorships for much of the last century, over and over again, issuing statements hoping for the peaceful transfer of power in the United States. The Brazilian politicians exclaiming that they hope that if Bolsonaro does not prevail in their next election, that they don't face the same thing happening in the United States. How could Beijing or the mullahs in Iran look at what's happening here, or in Moscow, Putin, look at this and not smile gleefully at the United States descending into this chaos in our country? It is something it's going to take a very long time to really reckon with. And Anne's piece, though written quickly, obviously, is only the very bare beginnings of that. But for anyone who's interested in that dimension of these events, it's a good place to start.
Thank you. That does touch on one of the aspects of this that is so horrifying, is the deep and profound shame we feel that it has come to this, that our country has come to this. I was struck this morning by a statement from the Turkish government saying that they called upon both sides in the United States to show restraint.
Why is that painful?
I would like to draw attention to something, though, that just struck me. Look, for a short time in my life, I worked on Capitol Hill. I revere our traditions, our history, recognizing, of course, all its flaws. But somebody did something yesterday that just had echoes for me. That when the violent mob was descending on the Senate chamber, some quick-thinking aide had the thought to grab the boxes that contained the Electoral College ballots from the states and secure them. And it sort of had echoes for me of, you know, Dolly Madison saving the portrait of George Washington as the British were going to come and burn the White House. Obviously, those actual boxes are not really essential because the states can resend, you know, the letters. But it was they're these big old-fashioned boxes with big old-fashioned straps on them. It's part of American history and tradition that that's the way they're presented. And I just felt, God bless that person, whoever it was, or the group of staffers who said, you know, we're gonna save these. It was something that I hope will be a symbol for the future rather than the desecration that was the overwhelming message. And with that, we thank you all. Thank you, Eric Edelman, for joining us again. Thank you all for listening. We will return next week, as every week.